Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This Earth Day was supposed to be the day that Oregon's Clean Energy Jobs Bill was signed into law. Instead, while industry groups try to water down the bill, environmental groups are still lobbying Oregon legislators to pass the strongest law possible. Meanwhile, today, extinction resistance activists are taking direct action to stop climate change's worst ravages and to basically call our lawmakers and elected officials to really do something instead of just talking about things. So today I have with me Damon Mott-Story, who's with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Pat DeLaQuille with 350PDX. And they came here originally to give us an update on the progress that HB 2020, the Clean Energy Jobs Bill, is making on its way to becoming law. But we're also going to be joined by Megan, who's on the tracks with the Extinction Resistant Activists, and she's going to give us an update on what's happening there. So, Damon and Pat, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you so much.
And we got Megan here, too. Megan, welcome to Locus Focus.
Great. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
So, well, we were going to just sort of talk before you got on about what's happening, but since you're on the line, Megan, why don't you tell us what's happening right now, where you are at Zenith Energy on the tracks?
Yeah, definitely. Currently, we are sitting on the tracks of the spur that leads into Zenith Energy Oil Terminal. People that are willing to be arrested have been sitting on the tracks since people from Zenith came to clear off some of the plants and soil that was on the tracks. They sat down in defiance of that, and Zenith has since left, and we are currently waiting for what's going to happen next.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. So maybe a lot of people, this has gotten some news coverage, but not enough. So tell people, what are you doing on the tracks by Zenith? And then we also should talk about why you are on the tracks. So first of all, where are you and what do you have there?
We yesterday came and planted what we're calling a victory over fossil fuels garden. So we've got a whole garden going and a little tiny house next to it. And basically we're doing that because we need to stop continuing with fossil fuels.
And what's happening at Zenith that is making that the target for why for energy to stop fossil fuels?
So basically Zenith is a great example of the problems with the discrepancy between what Portland is saying they want to happen and what's actually happening here. So Zenith brings in tar sands oil, which is extremely problematic type of oil. And not only are they bringing it in, but they're trying to expand and quadruple the amount of trains that they can process at any one time.
And how can they do this? I thought we had this fossil fuel infrastructure ban here in Portland. So how can they get away with this?
So currently they're grandfathered in so we have the ban is on new fossil fuel infrastructure, and they've been grandfathered in because they took over a lease from the company that owned it prior.
So I understand that the company that owned it before that was not processing tar sands oil. Instead, they were shipping asphalt, I believe, and a little bit of diesel, and basically not doing very much at all. So,
correct.
So it seems to me that there's a little bit of a discrepancy between what Zenith is doing now and what that original permit was for.
Definitely. And that's the problem, is that they get to work through these loopholes in which they can make these things happen, even when to us as citizens, it doesn't seem like it should be happening.
So a little bit later in the show, we'll talk more about what some of the plans are to try to really stop this at the governmental level. But right now, what I want to talk to you about is what's happening right there at Zenith on the tracks and what you expect to happen in the next few hours.
Right now, people willing to be arrested are sitting on the tracks, kind of singing songs and just, you know, putting ourselves in a good place because this is Earth Day and we're doing this for a reason. We're sitting here expecting the Portland police came earlier this morning and said that they would be back to clear us out. So right now we're kind of just in a waiting period to see when the police are going to show up and what's going to happen next.
And you have no idea when that's going to be.
We do not know.
Now, I talked with one of the activists in the track, Jan Zuckerman, a little while ago, and she's saying that people should come down and support. So she wanted me to put a call out to for action. So do you want people to come down and support you at this point?
Absolutely. If anybody can come down, it's great to be here in solidarity with the people who are putting themselves at risk for this cause. If you care at all, we would be more than happy to have you support in any capacity. So that would be great.
And where should people come?
So Zenith Energy Terminal is on Northwest Front Street. It's 5501 Northwest Front Street. And if you're just coming down front, you will definitely see us.
Yeah, actually, I think I was looking at routes, and it seems like the best route to do is to go down Vaughn and go the old way, if you're old enough to remember the old way, down to St. Helens Road, and then follow St. Helens Road, and it will turn into Kittredge Street, and then that will take you to Front. And then it's up on the left, I believe, about half mile. Is that correct?
Yep. Less than a half a mile from Kittredge.
Now, is the garden still growing, and are those sheds still up there, and the scarecrow and everything else that I saw in the photos that I got emailed yesterday?
That is all still up. We are concerned about the fact that if Portland police come, they may confiscate the plants that are currently in the ground. So we're kind of coming up with contingency plans on how to get that to gardens for low-income people.
Okay. Well, I'm going to let you go for now. If things change and the arrest is starting to happen, can you give us a call back? When they happen, and we'll give you the phone number right now. Or actually, you talk to my engineer, and he'll give you the phone number that you could call in on.
Great. Thank you so much.
So thanks a whole lot, Megan, and stay strong out there. And we're just talking with Megan, who is with Extinction Rebellion, and they have taken over railroad tracks outside the facility, Zenith Energy, which is hoping, I guess they've actually started to transport tar sands oil through Portland to ship it to Asia. And they're sitting on the tracks trying to stop these trains from coming. So now we have two people in the studio who are very excited to talk about this, as well as the subject that we originally were going to talk about. Damon Montsturi is with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Pat DeLaQuille is with 350 PDX. Welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you so much.
You all had big grins when I came in and said change of plan. So, and since then, Damon has been on his phone researching everything he can. So what have you come up with, Damon, so far that you want to share with us that give people more background about why the protesters are on the tracks and why they planted this garden? Actually, it's on top of the tracks, I believe. It's like they dumped a whole lot of dirt on the tracks and looked to me enough to stop a train.
That's right. And what I've heard is that there are no trains currently in the terminal. And so they're blocking right now any new trains from coming in. Pretty amazing. So, you know, what we saw recently in reporting in the Oregonian is that in the last year, this terminal single-handedly escalated Oregon crude exports to $71 million, up from the previous year's total of only $2,500. So, you know, you just got to follow the money, as is the case with so many things.
Well, let's also do a little background. Who is Zenith, and how do they get to take over this, what was pretty much a dormant terminal that wasn't doing any crude oil shipment at all, as far as I understand?
That's a good question. I don't have all the background here, but, you know, it's my understanding that they're taking advantage of an opportunity to sort of just adjust and kind of squeeze around an existing permit and therefore avoid Portland's historic fossil fuel zoning amendments ban, which would stop the major expansion of or construction of a new major fossil fuel infrastructure facility within our city. That was a really flagship piece of local policy that has really inspired a lot of other jurisdictions to do similar or bolder initiatives in other parts of the country. And they're finding a way to kind of take advantage of a loophole here, which is pretty unethical.
And I guess we'll be talking in the next few weeks. Actually, we're going to be doing a show about this next week as well. So we'll be talking about the ways that we can really put pressure on our elected officials to do something about this. But I've been spending a lot of time in Tacoma in the last year. And this business with Zenith sort of feels like business as usual in Tacoma. And I think a lot of us were really surprised that this kind of thing is happening in Portland. So my question, Pat, is why is this happening in Portland? How did this thing happen? Why is it that we don't have enough regulations or scrutiny or whatever we need to keep this from happening?
Well, I don't really know the answer to that. I mean, I have to look into the details, but it's obviously someone with a smart legal mind figured out how to get around the existing law by piggybacking on an existing permit. And so it's definitely unethical. It's unjust. In my mind, it's illegal, but it's again. And I want to give a shout out to the demonstration and the Extinction Rebellion, and because this is exactly the kind of civil disobedience that escalated the resistance to the Vietnam War back in those days, and really got people's attention and really motivated enough of a mass movement to really affect change. And so I hope this is something, and I love the example that they gave, very peaceful, very appropriate, very much focused on this is a statement that we are making on Earth Day, which I hopefully will resonate with a lot of people.
What I also really love is that they're declaring this area, they're rezoning it for open green space, mm-hmm. and that it's an example of how our zoning laws and everything else that's supposed to protect quality of life and maybe the planet here in Portland is not really effective enough. And I think that there's going to be a lot of talk in the coming weeks about how this area of Portland where Zenith is and it's way through Linton is really a sacrifice zone for fossil fuel industries in Portland and something that people don't really pay much attention to or think about if you don't live over there. Mm-hmm. So I think hopefully this is going to put a lot more focus on the fact that this area exists in Portland, which people ignore, which is really dangerous, and it's and now it's being abused even. We thought it was going to be phased out, and instead this whole thing is being expanded.
Right, and Physicians for Social Responsibility has for years been educating and informing the public about the risks of oil trains coming through our region, and how could we forget the horrible derailment that happened in Mosier in 2016, right? And so there's really important maps available for the groups that are fighting this proposal, this expansion, looking at the blast zones of where people would be most impacted. As you might be able to guess, the likelihood that that an explosion of this very volatile tar sands oil would happen in a community that is predominantly people of color is a lot higher than average, right? And so there's a disproportional impact on communities of color within Multnomah County.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today, we're talking with Damon Watts Story with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and Pat DeLaQuille, who's with 350 PDX. We were going to talk about HB 2020, which is about to become law, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But there's a breaking story that's been happening since early yesterday morning where activists have taken over the railroad tracks outside of Zenith Energy, a company that wants to expand or is actually trying to expand oil by rail terminal to export tar sands oil through Portland to Asia. And so there's a big demonstration happening there right now, and there's probably an arrest that's imminent. So we're tracking that throughout the show while we also talk about other things. Well, it's interesting. I was at a presentation that Stop Frack Gas PDX put on a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about where the tar sands oil was coming from, and they mentioned this place, Christina Lake, and this light bulb went on, and, you know, my memory, I work on so many things that a lot of things like slip into the far recesses of the file drawers of my mind, but Christina Lake popped out, and I thought, I was there, and it's the new fashion of tar sands extraction, and I visited it 5 years ago when I was doing a documentary about tar sands, and this extraction is not the kind, the huge open pit mining that we're all familiar with that you can see from outer space. This is underground, invisible to the naked eye, except for, but if you fly over it, you see that there's what's called seismic lines, which are these huge swaths of that are cut through the boreal forests where they basically are finding the places where they can start to dig and where the bitumen is. That's actually what tar sands is. It's kind of like asphalt. And they so they kind of really destroy and wreak havoc on the boreal forest, which is way, way up north in Alberta. And then once they find where the bitumen is and where they're going to extract it, they set up these huge pipelines underground. And it's a huge process where they have two pipes and one has steam is going through. And that steam heats what's in the other pipe, which is the bitumen, and it heats it so that it can actually flow through the pipe and then up into where it becomes processed into tar sands oil and eventually what they call dilbit, where they add things that are called dilutants, which actually make it less viscous so it can actually flow through a pipe. And this is a really amazing, massive facility, and very few people really know about it. So I find it interesting that the word has gotten out that this tar sands oil is not coming from the conventional sources, but from this the tar sands 2.0, I guess, the SAGD operations, as it's called. So I wonder how we can get people in Portland to understand exactly what's going on and how Portland is being used basically to be the spigot for some of the very worst fossil fuels in the world.
Yeah, an enormous amount, about 90% of all the state's fossil fuels go through Portland, right? And so we are the hub of trading infrastructure for our entire state's fossil fuels supplies. And so I think that's one of the things that's important for folks to know is that, like, we are sort of ground zero for a lot of this transit and infrastructure. You have mentioned that, you know, this stuff is highly, highly volatile. And really dangerous. And that's one of the things that we've actually also highlighted as a possible risk is that are the workers out at Zenith being properly protected when they're handling this stuff and opening up some of the valves on the tops of containers and things like that? Because as you rightly pointed out, this stuff is highly, highly volatile and dangerous.
Well, also, what's interesting about this particular plant, I think the Oregonian broke the story last week about how they were supposed to be doing trainings where the workers would be working with tar sands oil. But they didn't bother to do that. They just were going to use diesel and asphalt because that's what they had around. And somebody, the regulator from DEQ, this guy Smith, I believe, called them on it and said, this isn't okay. You have to do the correct training. And he mentioned it to his superiors at DEQ, and they said, don't worry about it. This is very disconcerting because DEQ is the agency that's supposed to protect our environmental quality, protect our health. And there's been a lot of other examples of where they've kind of missed the game. But what do you think about this one? And what are the possibilities of this major violation basically being grounds to shut down this process, this operation that Zenith is trying to do?
Well, I mean, I think absolutely. In my mind, The key policy that we need to be thinking about in terms of fossil fuels is we need to keep them in the ground. We need to stop our consumption as much as possible. And we should not let companies profit simply because they can take something out of the ground and sell it in Asia for a profit. That's not how we're going to build a just society. I think this whole idea of civil disobedience is gaining strength. There's going to be a film showing tonight at the Unitarian Church in Portland on 1211 Southwest Main Street. It's the necessity defense. It's about civil disobedience of the valve turners and how they've been able to use that legal defense. And I think this is, again, something that we're going to be seeing more of because the climate crisis is getting even more intense. And I think we're seeing, especially with all the momentum behind the concept of a Green New Deal, we're seeing more and more people get energized and activated in this area.
By the way, Ken Ward, who is a valve turner, has been down at the Zenith Garden.
Great.
So that's just a really fascinating connection there.
It's going to be a film screening and a panel discussion, and he may well be on the panel.
But I think that it's really inspiring and amazing, the reason for doing this, right? Because we're talking about the health of our present and future generations, right? The incredible direct threat of these highly volatile trains coming through our neighborhoods, and the insanity of continuing to allow loopholes and exceptions and exemptions for climate action when we have less than 12 years to take this meaningful stab to avert the worst case scenarios of climate catastrophe. So I think I'm really compelled by this. You know, we have to do everything we can to stop this. And I think this is really a call to our local elected leaders to use whatever power they can to shut this project down.
Well, I saw two letters in the last week, and one was written, I think, by Nick Caleb with some other people. It was addressed to City Council and Mayor Wheeler, and it was a very strong letter. Well, we'll talk about what's in there, but the one that was really interesting to me was one that was written yesterday by anonymous members of the Extinction Rebellion. And that letter was, have you seen that one?
No, I haven't.
It was actually, they printed the whole thing on the websites for Channel 2 and Channel 5, Channel 6. Interestingly, Channel 8 didn't cover it. And I haven't seen anything in the Oregonian about this yet either. So, but the letter from the Extinction Rebellion, it reminds me, it's like what I've heard a lot of people who are really frustrated with everything, just calling it out. And they were basically blasting Portland's climate action plan because it had no teeth in it. It wasn't doing anything. It could be called the Portland Climate Non-Action Plan, I mean, according to the letter. So reading that letter last night made me really think about the frustration that people are feeling. And then I thought about that big ship that was at Oxford Circus in London for several days blocking all traffic. And I was thinking how interesting it is, the symbols that people are using. I figured they're using the ship as an example of sea level rise.
Mm.
But what I really love was using creating a farm on the tracks here.
Because it's excellent image.
To me, let's just talk about what that image means and how that might be a way to bring elected officials up to speed in what they need to do.
Well, our sibling chapter in Washington State released a report a while ago that talks about the huge myriad of health benefits that come from more urban green spaces and more community gardens. And, you know, one of the ways in which Portland is doing really amazing climate action work is we're implementing the Portland Clean Energy Fund right now. And that has a huge amount. That's going to be, you know, millions of dollars available for not just renewable energy and energy efficiency, but also urban green spaces and community gardens, and really focusing on, you know, supporting indigenous and native gardening techniques that are being stewarded by indigenous members of the community, and increasing access to urban green spaces to low-income folks and people of color, right? Because all of that, you know, being able to grow food locally and sequester carbon and expand, it cleans up the airshed too. We have a big diesel pollution problem right now, and having all of these things developed out further is literally cleaning things up all around us. And it's very inspiring to see that that is, you know, being put into place as a ongoing, very large, consistent revenue stream that's going to invest in things like this little pop-up farm all over the city.
You know, we need political climate change before we're going to have really effective action on climate. And the more people that are inspired by these events and begin to vote and to make sure that we hold our politicians accountable for the actions that we're putting into law, that they actually get implemented. Because we can have a lot of talk, but if we don't have action, then it doesn't amount to anything.
Well, I'm wondering about what you think about the assessment that I sort of tried to sum up from the resistance Extinction Rebellion people, that what's been done so far really has not made much progress at all, and that most of it has been encouraging individual acts and kind of window dressing rather than being substantial. I mean, I agree with you, Damon, that I think that the Clean Energy Jobs Bill is...
The Portland Clean Energy Fund?
Fund, right. That, to me, is real. That really can make a difference. But I wonder about this other bill, the Clean Energy Jobs Bill that we're about to talk about, how much that will really make a difference and how far it would need to go to really meet the realities that are being addressed on the tracks in front of Zenith right now.
And actually, before we move away from local city climate action plan, I would just also mention that it was 2 years ago almost that Portland and Multnomah County committed to 100% renewables in our jurisdictions here. And this summer, they're going to need to produce a 2-year report where they, you know, that we're really going to need to look at where are we falling short and where are we measuring up. And I think that that's going to be an important opportunity for community dialogue about making sure that we really step up the pace on a lot of our local action.
Yeah, I can appreciate the sentiment that what's been done so far is probably not effective enough, but I don't think we should discount the progress that's been made, the gains with the renewable portfolio standard and with the clean fuels bill and with the coal to clean transition that's now part of the law. So this is another step. The Clean Energy Jobs Bill is a very significant step because it puts a legal cap on carbon emissions It's not everything. It's not a silver bullet. It's not comprehensive. It doesn't include agriculture and forestry. That doesn't mean it's bad. It simply means we have a lot more work to do, that we have to have come up with ways to reduce our emissions from agriculture and to transition to sustainable forestry, and that we need to do more in the transportation area. We need to have incentives to make it easier for people to get into electric vehicles and other clean types of transportation, public transit, et cetera, so that we are not just relying on price signals, but we're creating incentives for people to transition. And the faster we can transition, the less pain we'll suffer.
Well, I was just thinking, as you were talking about Oregon's land use laws and how they were revolutionary in their time in 1973. But I sort of started perceiving 20, 30 years later that some of the problems with Oregon's land use laws is they were really market-driven. It was really based on you try to limit the supply of land in a certain place and drive up prices in one place and keep prices lower in the other place where you don't want there to be development. And it's failed in a lot of ways. I mean, there's been lots, and it's particularly failed now that we see how much what's happening in the Willamette Valley with all these foreign interests coming in and buying up a lot of land and really driving up the price and driving many, many, many small farmers out of business and off their land. So I wonder how, because it feels to me that the Clean Energy Jobs Bill is still kind of based on market-driven mechanisms. What do we do to get beyond the market and to recognize that we have to find another set of values that is more substantial and far more equitable and also connected more holistically with what the needs are that we're trying to address?
Well, I think it's important to point out that it's not entirely a market mechanism. There is a legal cap on carbon that can be enforced. It does rely on the market to try to even out the various timing differences and costs that different companies and individuals will have in terms of how do they want to make this transition to a cleaner energy economy. But it's not, yes, I agree with you that there needs to be more goal-oriented activities to make it easier and more friendly for people to transition to the new technologies that we need to use in a clean energy economy. And so, yes, we have to take this bill and we have to have incentives. Again, I want to see incentives for electric vehicles. I want to see, especially for low-income people and or rural people who have a lot of driving that they have to do, you know, they need to get off of gasoline. And they need alternatives, and they want alternatives. They'll use them if they have them.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We're talking today with Pat DeLaQuille with 350 PDX and Damon Montstory with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And we're nominally talking about HB 2020, the Clean Energy Jobs Bill, which is about to be voted on. Oh, not quite there yet.
No. It's going to be a while.
Yeah, it's going to be a while. The legislature's got a lot going on right now. I'll let you finish.
Okay, so anyway, but we've also been talking about this action that's going on right now in Northwest Portland on the railroad tracks in front of Zenith Energy, a company that has designs to expand a moribund terminal into a major oil-by-rail terminal transporting tar sands oil that's going to be coming from northeastern Alberta through Portland and to China and the rest of Asia. Let's continue a little bit about what's going on with HB 2020 and why, because when we talked about this, over a month ago, mm-hmm. we set this date, Earth Day.
2 months.
2 months, right. And we set this date as Earth Day is the day it's going to be signed into law. So this is why.
We hoped.
So here we are, it's Earth Day. And by the way, happy Earth Day to everybody.
Yes.
But it's very far from being signed into law. So what's happening and what needs to happen before this becomes law?
Yeah, great question. The legislature has been a really fascinating building to be in this term. And so remember that in 2018, the Oregon voters reelected Kate Brown and elected in a supermajority of Democratic legislators in both the House and the Senate. And so the rhetoric kind of at the end of 2018 was, we can take really bold action now. It's been a little less than what we hoped. There's been a lot of different issues that have really been slowed down, and a lot of things have sort of taken different directions that we didn't really expect were going to have happen. Not just HB 2020, but a whole host of other bills. In that interim, we also saw this reporting from Rob Davis in The Oregonian showcasing that we are one of only 5 states in the entire country that has no campaign finance contribution limits from corporations, and that per capita, Oregon ranks as number 1 for corporate giving to political candidates. I personally think that there's that's worth mentioning because there's a lot of corporate influence on processes like the Department of Environmental Quality that we were talking about earlier, that has really meant that legislators, I think, have not been as bold as they should be in, you know, standing up to the Republican minority or to major corporate interests that are looking to defend their bottom line.
So what are some of the forces that are behind some of this foot dragging, and I understand what probably basically substitutions of something that actually is an action plan with something that would be basically status quo with a little bit of greenwashing on it.
Well, for one thing, Republicans really insisted upon a roadshow that would take basically take hearings for the Clean Energy Jobs Bill to different parts of the of rural Oregon, which I think was actually, you know, really great. It's important to hear from everybody on an issue, right? And especially a really big piece of legislation like this. Republicans are very much trying to just drag heels on this and slow it down. And I think across the board, it really behooves the environmental champions in the legislature to not give so much undue influence and airtime to a political party that's in the minority.
So do you think that they're bending over backwards too much to appease the Republicans?
Yeah.
So what can be done to get the Democrats to be reminded that they're in the supermajority and this is the time to act?
I think everyone listening should call their legislator and remind them that this is a different legislature than we've ever had before. And it's time to take action and to remember why it is this work is being done. We need to protect public health and public safety and remind legislators that that is more important than corporate contributions or appeasing Republican lawmakers.
Yeah. Well, it seems like it all comes down to campaign contributions, actually, and that's probably what – I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who say this, we really need – that's the bottom line issue.
It's the root of all evil in many ways, and it distorts our political system. It makes it very hard for our progressive supporters to craft something that will get through the building. And it's not just Democrats versus Republicans. It's some Democrats who are getting a lot of money from various interests who have looked for ways to kind of weaken the bill. Okay, so we need to make sure we're getting the message out to the Joint Committee and to our legislators that this is important, that we're going to be voting on this, that we're paying attention, we're going to hold them accountable. And we need to make sure that where our representatives are supportive and doing the right thing, that message gets up to the Speaker of the House and to the President of the Senate, that they know that this Joint Committee is doing the right thing, that we're paying attention, because they represent all of Oregon, not just their individual constituents.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting about that Oregonian article, that the reality of it is the largest corporate donations to campaigns is not from the fossil fuel industry here in Oregon. It's from the timber industry, which is historically what it's
right.
always
yes.
been.
Mm-hmm.
The fossil
it's
fuel
a huge industry,
industry
here.
Yeah,
and the Farm Bureau, too.
Right. And the fossil fuel industry actually gives more money to the Washington politicians than they do to Oregon. And there's a lot more fossil fuel interests in Washington at play. Mm-hmm. The large refineries.
Well, but the federal government has more jurisdiction over energy.
Right. So, but I can see in Washington State how all the fossil fuel contributions have really are at play with a lot of foot dragging, and why, I mean, Washington's further behind than we are in getting something like HB 2020 passed. I mean, they've tried and failed several times.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of like to dissect, like, what's going on here, because it's not just fossil fuel money. It seems like it's other vested interests that are facing reality, basically, that has to do with more than just fossil fuels.
Well, the narrative that, oh my God, this is going to raise gas prices by 16 cents and it's going to hurt farmers and more people, has been a strong message. That's not what the evidence shows in other jurisdictions, but that's a message that they've been using quite effectively. There's certainly some, as I understand it, some sentiment in the Senate to try to have some bipartisanship to this bill. I don't see it. Certainly, I think the committee vote is going to be on party lines. And I think that even though there are a lot of the Republican amendments are quite comical in terms of their hypocrisy.
They're really just meant to stall. Yeah.
Yes.
Give me a couple examples.
Oh, well, I don't think. Yeah, I think there's one amendment to require Portland to mandate electric vehicles. There's one that's actually quite useful, and that is to require that the public transit agencies transition to electric vehicles. So there are a couple of things that are being considered, as I understand it. But I think what we're going to basically see is they're working on a new amendment called the Dash 84 amendment that's going to strengthen the Dash 31 a little bit.
Now, what is Dash 34?
Well, all right. Okay. So we had the core bill that was released at the beginning of February, and then about several weeks ago, the committee released a new version, which they call the Dash 31 Amendment. So they rewrote the bill. And there were several gains in the bill in terms of removing the exemptions for the semiconductor industry, removing the exemptions for waste incineration, tightening the requirements or limiting the number of free allowances to these
manufacturers,
industry trade exposed industries.
How about Northwest Natural Gas and PGE?
So that one is still in play.
I'm glad you asked about that, because that's, you know, there was some reporting in the Portland Business Journal a while back that said that leaders on the Clean Energy Jobs Bill are negotiating with Northwest Natural and gas utilities around, you know, striking up some kind of a compromise. And so I think we need to be vigilant about that and push back on any proposal to give them a whole bunch of free handouts.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, just one other thing I would, you know, want to note, like, so this Dash 31 amendment came out. It was 128 pages long. And we're now working on a Dash 84 amendment, right? So they are numbered as they come in. And so this gives you a sense as to exactly how complicated and huge this process is.
So 84 comes after 131?
Well, each specific amendment is given a number.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. So, yes, there's been a lot of amendments, especially from the Republican side, to slow the process down. And this is a tactic that we understand is not being just used for this bill, but it's being used across the board on key pieces of legislation this session.
Now, is there a way to put an end to amendments? I mean, if the Democrats have a supermajority, can't they at some point decide?
Once they voted out of committee, then I understand. I don't know if I'm correct on this, but I was told that Oregon is different than some states, and they do not take amendments from the floor. So what comes out of the joint committee will be what gets voted on.
So that's probably good in terms of having this actually come to a vote before this, because the session ends in June, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. And it's important to remember the broader context here as well, is that the legislature is now really, you know, considering the revenue and the budget for the state and this student success initiative and a whole wide range of other really big stuff. And so that's what environmental priorities are competing with. For airtime. And we have a lot of people in the legislature who are working really hard to move forward environmental priorities, but it's incredibly difficult to kind of, you know, jockeying back and forth with those other things. One thing I do also want to point out as well is just that there is not a unified consensus among, you know, very progressive environmental groups around a market-based mechanism like cap and trade being really the right way forward. So I just wanted to name that, just because, like, that is sort of one part of the very complicated milieu of...
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, I've done a number of shows stretching back now many years. And I remember one of the first shows I did about cap and trade, I had Eric DePlace when he was... Sightline was still a very new organization, and he talked about it. And I thought did a good job of explaining it, because I had thought before that it was just basically a fancy form of indulgences. It didn't strike me as being, you know, but I understood when he explained it, I understood that it had a lot more teeth. But I also had, shortly after I had him on, I had a couple more radical environmentalists who basically saw it all, whether it's, they basically confused offsets with cap and trade, I think, but they saw it all as basically being indulgences. So I think that there is a lot of confusion about it. And I wonder, do you argue with yourself about cap and trade, or do you think that it's actually it's a good mechanism?
Well, you know, if and when this bill passes, we're going to need to be really careful about it. And regardless of how an individual group feels about it one way or the other, there are a lot of things that we've sort of been able to learn from in California's circumstances and in other jurisdictions that have considered these similar types of projects. A new report just came out recently that said that there's been a lot of potential abuse of the carbon offsets portion of the California cap and trade system, and that there may be as much as a third of the carbon reductions from that program that are not actually happening, right? Like, basically, you know, forest interests are saying that they're keeping forests standing in carbon offset programs, but are not actually. They're actually logging those forests. And so we, if and when this bill passes, we need to band together to make sure to watchdog it really carefully.
It needs a 1,000 friends of HB 2020.
Yes. I mean, implementation is always key to any piece of legislation. And I don't, you know, again, I don't believe this is the only piece of legislation that we need. This is, again, part of a fabric of pieces of legislation, and we need more on the incentive side. But coming back to the bill itself, and then because of the complicated nature of the bill, we do have to be very vigilant. We have to make sure, and there are some task forces built into the bill that we're going to help oversee the whole offsets program to make sure that those things are verifiable and real and long-lasting. Again, that's not something that's hard to monitor, but it takes vigilance, and it takes agencies with enough funding and mandate to go ahead and do that to make sure that those programs are implemented correctly.
Yeah, I'll give another example too, which is that the bill currently will give a bunch of free allowances to electric utilities for their fossil fuel generation for the first 10 years of the program. And the way that that's going to happen is the electric utilities will have to come to the Oregon Public Utility Commission, which is the body that regulates utilities in Oregon, and they're going to have to project out their fossil fuel emissions from the year 2021 to the year 2030. And that's what's going to be used for that entire decade to calculate how many free allowances they get under the program for their fossil fuel emissions. So we got to watch that process and make sure they don't cook the books, right? Because if they get a whole bunch of extra allowances or just a whole bunch of sort of wiggle room, then they may not actually decarbonize as fast as they need to.
How would that be watched?
Well, again, their integrated resource planning process is a public process at the Public Utilities Commission, and I know there are many people out there who follow that very carefully and have the technical expertise to try to keep track of what PG&E and PacifiCorp are telling the
right.
commission.
Sounds like another job for CUB as well.
Yes.
They've been doing a good job, I think, of tracking this.
Yeah,
stuff,
and
actually.
You know, 350 and the Sierra Club and the Physicians for Social Responsibility have been tracking the Public Utilities Commission's process for a long time, you know, like to ensure, for example, that Pacific Power, one of the other major private utilities in Oregon, is being open and transparent about the costs of their coal generation in other states, right? Because they're presenting a lot of their electricity as least cost, least risk. But is it really? Are they actually being fully transparent about that? That's why it's really important for us to watchdog that.
Yeah, it's the definition of risk. Their risk is a financial risk to them and not public health risk to us.
Correct.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Damon Mott-Story with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and Pat DeLaQuille with 350 PDX. And we're talking right now about HB 2020, the Clean Energy Jobs Bill that is grinding its way through the legislative process.
It's a pretty good word for it.
Yes, it is.
I'm sort of imagining that sausage getting filled with all kinds of strange debris and things like that.
There's a lot of action, and then there's a lot of waiting. They have to wait for legislative council to draft the changes that they want to see.
So what do you think is the prognosis for it actually passing this session?
I've learned over the years of working with state legislatures that you should never, ever say never. anything can happen, and a lot of, you know, trading and deals are made and back and forth and things like that will happen. What we do know is that Senate President Peter Courtney has said this will get a vote on the floor, and that's actually pretty rare for him on environmental priorities to give that degree of certainty to ensuring that at least it goes up for a vote.
And then Tina Kotek, I'm assuming the Speaker of the House, is probably a little bit easier. She's got a little easier position, and she's a little bit more supportive.
Yeah, she's been quite supportive. I think she is looking for the environmental community to make their voices heard, to make sure that we're pushing very hard, because those Democratic legislatures, they need to hear from us, and they need to know that we care and that we're going to support them to make this tough decision. There's going to be some political blowbacks to some degree. We don't know how the opponents, the fossil fuel interests are going to shape that, but we have to anticipate that. And again, so, you know, the more our legislators can say, I'm really hearing from my constituents, this is an extremely important issue, then it makes it easier for them to stand up to their other colleagues.
So keep those phone calls and postcards coming and emails and whatever else.
Yeah.
And,
absolutely.
And you know, put in what is important to you. You know, this is a big bill and there's a lot of different – we're still in the sausage-making phase. So I would suggest to listeners of this program to call their legislator or call and email members of the Joint Committee on Carbon Reduction and say, don't cut a deal to the gas utilities.
Right.
Right? Like, keep it strong on gas because, you know, we know that fracked gas is doing terrible things to communities across the world, and that methane gas, which is the main component of natural gas that's used for Northwest Natural and other things, heats the atmosphere at a rate 86 times more effectively than carbon dioxide
in a 20-year
period. 20-year period. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's an illusion out there that natural gas is cleaner than coal. But from a greenhouse gas perspective, if you look at the entire fuel cycle for that natural gas and the emissions of methane that happened in the production and the transmission and the storage and the handling, it's not any better than coal. So we need to transition away from that. People should be using heat pumps and not gas furnaces. And so,
we need to make that easier. I mean, that's the other thing. I'm getting a new hot water heater next week, and we looked into a heat pump.
You can get a heat pump.
We can't.
It's pricey.
It's not only pricey; it doesn't fit in our basement.
Oh,
the guy who's going to install. I mean, he basically looked at our basement and said, "I'm not putting a heat pump in here." Mm. But he said, "Coming soon is you basically have a heat pump like you have your air conditioner outside, and then you just have the tank in the basement itself."
Right.
But
yeah, there's no reason those units can't be split.
Right. But right now it's super expensive to do that,
mm-hmm.
and we also had a problem with running a 220. Circuit all the way over to where the hot water heater is because we have a finished basement. It was very complicated. So I went through this whole thing trying to do the right thing. And it makes me think about with people who have less means than me that it's really hard to do the right thing.
Would one of you explain what heat pumps are and why they're better than gas? Just real briefly.
Oh, yeah. A heat pump uses electricity to essentially it's a heat pump is a reverse air conditioner. And so it takes, I don't know how techno you want me to get, but it takes advantage of the fact that when you boil a liquid, it absorbs heat, okay? And if you can find a liquid that you can boil at a low temperature or condense at a high temperature, then you can basically suck heat out of a room. And so, or you can, for a heat pump, for the water heater, they basically suck heat out of the atmosphere and put it into your water. And so, and their efficiencies are actually quite high. Okay, usually a factor of 300% or something like that.
Because actually, I mean, I think gas water heaters are quite a bit more efficient than electric water heaters, and heat pumps seem to me are more efficient even than gas water heaters.
Yes, that's you're absolutely correct on that priority. Right.
I just wanted to ask that because I think it's really actually very exciting. We get very, you know, wonky and technical, but I think it's really exciting to think of the ways in which we can power past all of the fossil fuels that are currently in our grid, right? And like people can't, you know, imagine, you know, heating their homes entirely off of solar power, for example. But it's possible and it's efficient. And all we need to do is open up the right revenue streams to ensure that that's affordable for everyone and equitably accessible.
One of the problems, I've always found that I've been like a couple of years ahead of the curve to my detriment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we went all natural gas in 93 was the best thing to do, right? And then by 2003, I went, whoops. But you make these investments in stuff, in furnaces that can cost like $8,000. And this hot water heater is going to be over $1,000. And so these are kind of, and for people, low-income people, these are really major investments that you're making. And then to find 2 years later, well, there's a better technology, but I just spent $8,000 for my furnace. So how, and so I think that that's something else where if there are government buybacks or something like that, so that somebody who had invested in what's become a real archaic infrastructure, which was state of the art 2 years before, that there would be a way to give them incentives to actually do the right thing. And I mean, be the right thing for them as well as for the planet.
Yeah, that's why policies like the Portland Clean Energy Fund are really important to be, you know, standard bearers for best practices with these sorts of things because, you know, every pool of money that comes from the Portland Clean Energy Fund is meant to be prioritized for low-income folks and people of color, recognizing that historically that's been the hardest demographic to reach in and, you know, cleaning up different grid components and things like this.
Another thing I've been thinking about when you were talking before about electric vehicles, and I was thinking how do we get electric, how do we get charging stations up like on Mount Hood? On the trailhead parking. Sure. They have to be solar powered or something, but that's one of the, for me, the worst, or the biggest disadvantage about getting an electric vehicle is I like to go hiking a lot, and I go to places that are beyond the range of the car, and I'd love to be stuck up, you know, somewhere up in the far reaches of Mount Adams, and my battery is dead. Mm-hmm. So those are kinds of thoughts. And I think that we're still a little bit of ways away from that, and these are some of the things that are disincentives for people to transition off of fossil fuel.
Yeah.
Well, the transition is going to take time. I mean, if we had things like appliance standards that, like we did until this current administration scrapped them, efficiency improvement standards for vehicles, we could have the same for air conditioners and water heaters. And so there's a schedule where industries have to, they can only sell something that meets a certain minimum standard, and that standard increases over time. And so people can plan to some degree. Do I want to replace my furnace now, or do I want to wait another 2 years when it's going to be a little bit more efficient and maybe a little bit less cost expensive? The timing of things doesn't always work out in everyone's favor, but as a society, we have to manage that transition and make it as easy for people, especially low-income people, as possible.
Well, actually, I want to throw out one more thing. This is a curveball, but there's been one other big piece of news over the weekend, and that has to do with methanol refinery that's being proposed in Kalama. Mm-hmm. And Columbia Riverkeepers did a big news break. They released to Oregon Public Broadcasting this PowerPoint presentation that was done by Northwest Innovation Works, the company behind the refinery, to a lobbyist that they were trying to get money from, saying that this methanol would be used for fuel in China, which is exactly what they're not saying when they're getting their permits.
Yeah, they're trying to hide that.
Right. And I just want to get a take from you guys, what you think, what kind of impact this might have on whether this methanol refinery actually gets permitted.
Yeah, I think people really need to look at that report. There's a lot of sort of shady things going on with Northwest Innovation Works. They are a Chinese corporation. They're looking to profit off of fossil fuel exports in our region. And this methanol refinery would be the largest methanol refinery in the world, and its plume would reach as high or higher than the Mount St. Helens Peak. And so that would really be this just monstrosity that would use more gas than absolutely every other sector in Washington State combined. Yeah. So there'd be an enormous local and regional impact to this, and it would be a big step backwards on climate action.
So do you have
methanol? I don't know much about Zenith or the, but I know China. I've worked in China for well over 10 years, and there is a large lobby in China for using methanol as fuel. It's dirty. It's poisonous. It is a nasty fuel.
And, is it worse than gasoline, do you think?
And all the studies, it's worse than gasoline, absolutely. And all the studies that have been done have shown that methanol is not a good substitute for gasoline, and yet they persist.
Well, what I loved about this report that came out, and I do give kudos to OPB for running this. It was really an important breaking story. That activists in Tacoma, back when they were proposing the methanol refinery there in 2015, and then the activists in Kalama and Columbia Riverkeeper and everybody else who's been fighting the refinery has been saying all along, they're going to be using it for fuel. Because there's no market for olefins, which is what they're saying they're going to do to make plastics. And so it just reminds me of the Pentagon Papers, like everything that's in it. We knew this already. So the next step is like, how do we take that information and run with it?
Right. Yeah.
And we'll be doing some more shows on that, actually.
And there's a lot of locals in Kalama that are doing great work to show their opposition to the project.
Right. And there's going to be a camp out on the Kalama River on May 18th, which is Mount St. Helens Day, actually.
Oh,
and it's
right.
going to be going all day. And I think the camp out might actually start the night before. And there'll be Right. It'd be a great opportunity to learn about the struggle to stop methanol in Kalama.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to thank you, Damon and Pat, for being with us. And we'll just keep checking in and finding out if this bill. So maybe in June we should have another.
I think that's a good idea.
Let's plan on that.
Okay, we'll talk about that. Well, thanks a lot. We've been talking today with Damon Mott-Story with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and Pat DeLaQuille with 350PDX, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Mia Reback about Zenith Energy's plans to ship tar sands oil from Portland to Asia. This was written before all this happened this weekend. And actually, I'm going to be going out there right now to find out what's happening. You can go out, too, to 5501 Northwest Front Avenue. It's right near the junction of Front Avenue and Kittredge. And watch the people on the tracks and look at the farm.
And follow Extinction Rebellion PDX on Facebook
updates. My engineer is Ray Bodwell. Thanks, Ray, for stepping in. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Van Morrison. Thanks for listening.
When all the dark clouds roll away, young sun begins to shine. I see my freedom from across the way, and it comes right in on time. When it shines so bright.